When you picture a heavy metal show, the first thing that comes to mind is, well, probably just pure, unfiltered chaos.
Right, just bodies colliding, hair everywhere.
Exactly. Loud guitars, the mosh pit, it feels entirely unscripted. But today, we are taking a source that kind of strips away all that noise.
It really does.
Yeah, it looks at the mosh pit through this surprisingly cold, highly analytical lens. We're diving into a piece called The Dumbass Guide to Headbanging, the updated edition.
Such a great title.
It is. And the author initially published these findings back in 2006, but they've updated the text to give us this comprehensive, I mean, almost biological breakdown of headbanging. Our mission for this deep dive is to see what happens when you treat the pit not as a riot, but as a complex ecosystem with its own, physics and taxonomy.
It is a really fascinating juxtaposition because you have the visceral, primal aggression of the music on one side, and then on the other, the author is applying this rigid, almost Linnaean classification to the signature dance of the culture.
Like a scientist.
Exactly like a biologist studying a completely new species. They break down the mechanics, the spatial dynamics, and ultimately the severe physical toll of it all. It provides a framework that elevates what looks like just a random act of flailing into a highly codified cultural practice,
Yeah.
and one with very real biomechanical consequences for you if you participate.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to truly understand the taxonomy, we have to look at the literal origin. And the story the author provides is just wild.
It really surprised me.
Right. So we are going back to 1968. Led Zeppelin is on their very first United States tour playing the Boston Tea Party. The author notes that the term headbanger was literally coined at that specific gig.
Which is incredible history just on its own.
Totally. And the audience in the front row, they weren't just nodding along. They were so overwhelmed by the sheer heaviness of what they were hearing that they were physically banging their heads against the wooden stage in rhythm with the music.
Literally banging their heads.
Yes, they were using the architecture of the venue as a percussion instrument with their own skulls.
What's fascinating here is how a completely literal, localized act of rhythmic striking evolved into a simulated action. I mean, it started with people actually risking concussions against a piece of wood.
Yeah, actual trauma.
Right. But over the decades, it transformed into this legendary dance form. The physical impact against an object was replaced by the simulation of impact through open air.
Which is where the aesthetic comes in.
Exactly. The author highlights that as this evolution happened, a crucial aesthetic element became mandatory, and that is long hair.
You gotta have the hair.
You do. Because the hair acts as a visual extension of the kinetic energy. If you think about the physics of it, the hair functions as a pendulum.
Right.
It exaggerates the movement, creating that iconic sweeping visual that defines the genre. And at the same time, it hides the face to strip away individual identity, merging the person into the collective rhythm of the crowd.
The hair is absolutely the crucial instrument here because you can't just flail around. Well, I mean, you can, but the author categorizes the resulting styles based on tempo, aggression, and spatial awareness. It's very specific.
It is. And sure, you can mix these up with the classic devil horns or, lip syncing, but there are distinct foundational pillars. First, there's the baseline, which is the up and down, just the classic vertical shake. Think Wayne's World during Bohemian Rhapsody.
A classic pop culture moment.
Exactly. Then the physical demands immediately escalate with a circular swing, though anyone who has ever been to a show knows this as the windmill.
Oh, absolutely. The windmill.
This is the massive, continuous circular motion originally popularized by Blackie Lawless, but entirely dominated today by George Corpse the Grinder, Fisher of Cannibal Corpse, and of course the guys in Amon Amarth.
And if we look at someone like Corpse a Grinder, it perfectly illustrates the biological extremes the author is pointing toward.
His neck is unbelievable.
It really is. You are taking an average human head, which weighs about 10 to 11 pounds, adding the weight of sweat-soaked hair and swinging it in a continuous circle at upwards of 120 beats per minute.
That is a lot of force. The centrifugal force generated is massive. Corpse the Grinder's neck is famous in the metal community because it is literally wider than the base of his skull.
That's just wild to look at.
But that isn't just an aesthetic, it's a literal biological adaptation. His body has had to build a massive column of muscle just to withstand the G-forces of the windmill without snapping his cervical spine.
That is insane to think about, an evolutionary adaptation just for death metal. Now, if you don't have that kind of neck strength, the author notes you might fall into the drunken style, Immortal famously champions this one.
Yes, the chaotic approach.
Right. It's less about rhythm and more about just surrendering to the chaos, banging your head in totally random, unhinged directions. But it's not just an aesthetic choice. It's a complete loss of proprioception.
Which is your body's ability to sense its movement in space.
Exactly. The author points out that people attempting the drunken regularly lose their center of gravity and just topple over.
Moving beyond those chaotic foundations, the taxonomy shifts into how performers manipulate geometry. We see styles that operate on very specific spatial planes.
Like drawing shapes in the air.
Precisely. For example, the half circle, which was the absolute signature of Slayer's Tom Araya. You were swinging the head repeatedly from side to side, but in a distinct pendulum-like downward arc across the chest.
So it's controlled.
Very controlled. It maintains the aggressive momentum, but controls the kinetic energy a bit more predictably than a full windmill.
Right. And keeping with the spatial manipulation, you have the figure eight, tracing an invisible eight in the air. But then things get really interesting with the side to side.
That one changes the axis completely.
It does. Instead of moving vertically or circularly, you are whipping your hair directly from shoulder to shoulder. Robert Trujillo, Slipknot's Mick Thompson, the late Alexi Laiho, they all utilize this.
It creates a totally different vibe.
A completely different visual rhythm. Instead of the head moving with the downbeat, the hair whipping horizontally cuts across the visual field.
The contrast between those planes of movement is important. But the author also categorizes these styles by their social and destructive dynamics. Take the whiplash, for instance.
Oh, man, the whiplash.
Pioneered by Angus Young and perfected by Cliff Burton. This is a hyper-violent vertical shake. The speed is so intense that the hair completely obscures the face.
You can't see anything.
Nothing at all. It is an incredibly isolating style. You are completely locked into your own kinetic bubble. But contrast that with the tandem.
The cooperative one.
Yes, fundamentally cooperative. Two or more people, like K.K. Downing and Glenn Tipton of Judas Priest, standing shoulder to shoulder, synchronizing their movement.
It looks so cool live.
It takes an individual act of rebellion and transforms it into a militaristic, synchronized display of unity. It requires total awareness of the person next to you.
I love the visual of that unified front on stage. But obviously, not everyone in the crowd has that kind of spatial awareness. The author categorizes one style very bluntly as the asshole.
Yes, that one.
This is the person violently swinging forwards and backwards from the waist, taking up a massive footprint in the pit, and inevitably headbutting the people around them.
I'm actually going to interrupt right there and push back on the author's framing for a second.
Oh, good.
I wouldn't classify that as a style at all. That is simply a complete violation of the social contract of the pit.
That's a great point.
The mosh pit, despite its chaotic appearance, relies heavily on communal etiquette. Throwing your waist around blindly and breaking the noses of the people trying to enjoy the show next to you isn't a technique. It's just poor situational awareness.
That is a completely fair point. It is definitely bad pit etiquette. Now, if you want to be destructive without hurting others, the author notes the all out.
Which is just punishing to your own body.
It really is. You literally drop to the ground, support yourself on your arms, and violently swing your head between them. You completely destroy your own balance. Sometimes you literally have to grab onto the barricade just to keep the momentum from throwing your body across the floor.
It's pure commitment.
Pure commitment. But on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, say you're listening to this in your office cubicle right now, the author pitches the low profile.
For the corporate metalhead.
Exactly. It is a subtle micro variation of the up and down. You can get your metal fix on your morning commute without HR or your fellow passengers getting involved.
It highlights the sheer adaptability of the practice. But whether you are doing a micronaut on the subway or the all out on a festival floor, the underlying biomechanics remain the same. And this is a crucial misconception the author corrects. Headbanging is not a neck exercise.
That feels counterintuitive.
It does, but if you isolate the movement purely to your cervical spine, you will injure yourself almost immediately. To sustain the movement, the entire body has to engage. The author refers to a serpentine motion running through the torso and the spine.
So what does this all mean?
If you think of a stiff stick versus a bullwhip, if you hold a stick rigidly and try to snap the tip back and forth, the stress concentrates at a single point and the wood snaps.
Okay, that makes sense.
But a bullwhip distributes that kinetic energy in a fluid wave down its entire length. If a headbanger locks their back and only moves their neck like a rigid stick, all that shearing force from the weight of their head and hair concentrates directly on the C4 and C5 vertebrae.
Ouch.
Exactly. By incorporating a serpentine motion, they allow the spine to act like the whip, undulating and distributing the G-forces through the larger muscles of the back and core, which drastically reduces the strain on the fragile neck cartilage.
That explanation makes so much sense. You have to distribute the force, and you can't distribute that force if your feet aren't planted correctly, which is why the author breaks down the architecture of the bang. The stance is required to manage your center of gravity so you don't face plant.
Balance is everything.
It is. You have the wide stand just anchoring your balance with legs apart. Then the brace, where you bend your knees and put your hands on your thighs. This lowers your center of mass and is perfect for absorbing the momentum of the half circle.
The stances are essentially base of support modifications. If someone wants to maintain a rigid upper body, they might use the arrested stance, clasping their hands behind their back to lock their shoulders.
Very authoritative.
But if we look at the stride, one leg forward, one back, hands held low, this is highly tactical. The author notes this is crucial for the pit. From a physics standpoint, the stride widens your base of support along the sagittal plane.
Meaning you won't get knocked over easily.
Right. Meaning you are vastly more stable and resistant to the unexpected forward or backward impacts of a crowd crush.
It is literally survival physics in the pit. And then for pure stage presence, you have the shredder. Stretching your legs out into a massive lunge, dropping your body inches from the floor while ripping an air guitar. It takes incredible flexibility, but it looks amazing.
Pure showmanship.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. After establishing an honorable Headbangers Hall of Fame, shouting out gods like Hetfield, Kerry King, and Dimebag, right alongside a local legend named Mark G., which brilliantly highlights the grassroots nature of the scene, the article takes a massive tonal shift.
It really does.
It pivots from celebrating the mechanics to confronting the brutal, long-term medical reality of the dance, the bangover.
It's the most sobering section of the analysis. The author looks back roughly 20 years to when the prevailing consensus was that headbanging was fundamentally safe.
People just didn't know.
The text brings up Jason Newsted leaving Metallica. While the cartilage wear in his neck was known, the public viewed it as a freak anomaly. But the author makes it very clear. We now possess decades of medical evidence proving the belief was a myth.
It's hard to reconcile.
The psychological dissonance here is staggering. You have a culture built entirely on an ethos of invincibility, rebellion, and pushing limits. But it is constantly crashing into the frail, unforgiving reality of human biology.
The injuries listed are terrifying. We all know what it's like to sleep on our neck wrong and be in pain for 2 days. Now imagine whipping an 11-pound weight on top of your spine for 30 years.
The damage is cumulative.
Tom Araya, the master of the half circle we talked about, completely destroyed his cervical spine. He had to have titanium plates surgically screwed into his neck and is permanently forbidden from headbanging. Dave Mustaine developed severe stenosis.
Which is incredibly painful.
Right, a narrowing of the spinal canal that pinches the nerves. Directly from the repetitive stress.
And the sheer trauma can mask itself through the adrenaline of the performance. The author notes that Corey Taylor of Slipknot actually broke his neck and didn't realize it at the time.
I still can't believe that.
The performance environment normalized such a high threshold of pain that a catastrophic structural failure of his spine went unnoticed until it required immediate surgical intervention. But the risks aren't just orthopedic, they are cardiovascular.
That was the part that actually made my jaw drop. The author details the case of Terry Balsamo from Evanescence. He suffered a stroke, and the doctors linked that stroke directly to a torn neck artery caused by violent headbanging. Moving your head to the music literally gave a rock star a stroke.
To understand the mechanics of that, you have to look at arterial dissection. When the neck is violently hyperextended during something like the whiplash, the vertebral artery is stretched significantly.
Right.
That rapid, violent stretching can actually tear the delicate inner lining of the artery wall. Blood then enters that tear, pooling and forming a clot. If that clot breaks loose and travels to the brain, it causes an ischemic stroke. The human neck simply did not evolve to accommodate the localized, high-velocity, shear forces of heavy metal over a multi-decade touring cycle.
It is a massive physical sacrifice these artists gave their bodies to the music. And that brings us to the author's final practical warnings for you, the listener.
Very important advice here.
If you are going to jump into the pit, you cannot ignore your biology. You must stretch beforehand to warm up those muscle groups. Know your own physical limits.
Absolutely.
The author strongly advises against headbanging blindly while heavily intoxicated. Because as we learned with the drunken style, losing your proprioception is a fast track to the floor. Above all, listen to your body. Practice safe headbanging.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, heavy metal has unwittingly provided the medical community with a real-world longitudinal study on repetitive spinal trauma.
A completely accidental study.
Exactly. And this raises an important question. Considering the devastating physical toll, the titanium plates, the stenosis, the arterial dissections, what exactly will the future of audience participation look like? The current generation of legendary metalheads, both on stage and in the crowd, are aging out of their ability to safely whip their hair.
That is a fascinating point.
When biology inevitably demands a change, how does a culture so deeply rooted in visceral physical aggression adapt? Will we see the invention of a completely new, low-impact form of heavy metal expression take over the mosh pits of tomorrow? Or will the scene stubbornly refuse to evolve, accepting the injuries as a necessary rite of passage?
That is a deeply provocative thought to leave off on. It makes you look at a crowd of thousands of people moving in unison in a completely different light. Not just as fans, but as a biomechanical phenomenon pushing the absolute limits of the human body.
It really changes your perspective.
It does. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the wildly complex, spatially fascinating, and medically terrifying world of headbanging. We hope you took away some crucial insights. And remember, if you're pulling out the low profile on the train today, protect your neck. We will see you next time.